This is Spoiler Country Presents, a commentary track. Where creators give you behind-the-scenes information on the comics you love.
Hi, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenner Regan. That right there is Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, it's the second time for Frank Gogol's commentary track for book two of Dead End Kids.
Yeah, Dead End Kids, man. The thing is selling like crazy. It's sold out of its first printing.
Yeah.
Its second printing is out. From what I heard, the second issue already sold out of its first printing.
That's crazy.
It's just like...
it's going gangbusters. I know he sold out at Midtown Comics in New York City, which I think is kind of... it's somewhat of a meter, right?
It is. Well, what's really cool too is I follow him on Twitter, and I have for a while, right? And he posted he had an article, I think it was on Bleeding Cool or one of the websites, talking about the numbers behind the sellout of like what they print, how many numbers they printed, and how they determined to go to the second printing. It was actually like, it was pretty eye opening because it was just straightforward. Here's the numbers. Here's what we did as far as like printing and stuff. And it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. It's kind of fun to see somebody like be open about how they come about publishing the book, how they came across all the different things they're doing with the book, how they, you know, and really we're doing a commentary track series of interviews with creators we think are impactful. But really this comes from Frank Gogol's mind. He's the one that kind of gave us this idea.
Yeah, he came to Casey asking if we'd be interested in doing this. We're like, hell yes, we would. And we're like, that's a great idea. We should do more of these with more creators. And so, I mean, it's thank you again, Frank, for letting us do your idea and thinking of us to do these commentary tracks on for your amazing book, Dead End Kids.
So, well, let's just get into it and see how the conversation with Casey and Frank goes.
First, let's real quick recap the first issue.
I was about to say, especially at least that last page. So, okay. Recap for sure.
All right. So, in issue one, we opened with Ben being dead under the water, and then we flash back 24 hours and sort of got to know all of our kids and, you know, their home lives and their relationships to one another. We sort of pull the carpet out from under the kids' lives by killing Ben, and we see how they react. Murphy doesn't take it well. He starts sort of lashing out a little bit. He decides that Ben was too smart to go out on the ice and fall through, and he thinks Ben's been murdered, so they investigate. And while they're investigating, they find Bulmer, the local bully's switchblade, out on the ice. And just as that happens, Bulmer is strolling up to the lake with a baseball bat. And that's sort of where we left off at the end of issue one.
Awesome. Okay, so issue two starts off. Let's, I guess, dive into the cover.
Yeah. So this is by far... and above, in a way, my favorite cover of the series. I think it's just absolutely the most eye-catching. It's sort of, it's got that same sort of iconic flavor as the first issue, but I think it asks more questions. It's the three kids sort of laying how you imagine three kids would lay, sort of like in like a grassy field in like some kind of like almost like a dream sequence, maybe. They're just sitting there relaxing. And where the fourth kid would be, there's the outline of a body. And they're on the street instead of in a field. And I think with the sort of black and white on a popping color motif we have across all the issue covers, this one definitely is like the most eye-grabbing and the most sort of raw-looking one. Chris Madd, who did that for the series, he absolutely, he did it, and he added like all these little puddle inside of Ben's outline is like a nice little touch, you know, because he fell through a lake. But they've got these literal holes punched in them. That sort of ties into the type to sort of find out what fucked up all the kids. Symbolic, right?
Yeah.
And we know the heart of the team. Murphy is just full of holes because he's like the most fucked up of all of them. If we talked a little bit too much about it right now, but for that one ties into the story. What I wanted to do with this, honestly, was make it have that iconic feeling, but make something that when you look back at it after, you can peel back layers to it, like an ad. I don't know if anyone will pick up on any or all of that, but for me, like, that was important going into designing the covers.
So just anecdotally, when I went into reading this, I started looking at it a lot more. I realized that after our first talk, nothing was by accident on your covers. Little clues were throughout the story. So I read it a little bit more deeply. Closely. Yeah, for sure. Than I would have had I've just been, you know, flicking through and just having a Casey sitting on the couch having a nice pleasure read, which I enjoyed the hell out of it. But yeah, I definitely looked at it a lot closer than I normally do, just because I know there's that attention to detail.
Yeah, this is something that I really strive to do with all of my stories. Like In Grief, the first book I put out, the short story collection, the title of almost every story comes on the last page of the story, and it's usually a double entendre, like, you know, for the plot of the story, but also sort of the meaning of the story. So like, you read the story once, you get the title, and then when you go back and read it again, the title has a second meaning when you read through the second time. That was sort of what I was experimenting with here with the cover. Not so much as like a additive in like a double meaning sense, but in a, if you look at this cover after you read the story, you might get more out of it kind of sense. And I stole this from Alan Moore. He does this at the end of every issue of Watchmen. If you read an issue of Watchmen, at the end, the last panel on the last page is always a black one with a quote in it. And if you read that quote, you know, and you go back and read the issue, you'll notice all kinds of different little stylistic and dialogue choices that he made. One of the most obvious ones is, you know, if you're a literature major like I was, I think it's the fifth issue of Watchmen, ends with a stanza from The Tiger by, oh God, what's his name? William Blake. And it's, you know, it's a reference to this poem that William Blake wrote called The Tiger, but it was also had like an illuminated image that went with it of this like really pale, sad tiger. And if you go back and read Watchmen number five or six, you can see that the coloring choices are all sampled from that illuminated image from the poem. Some of the dialogue is from it. Rorschach and the tiger from the poem have like a very similar demeanor and story in the issue. It's pretty wild like what Moore was able to achieve in that book. Every time I read it, I pick up something new and I try to, you know, put that tool in the toolbox. So this is like Frank's bastardized version of Alan Moore.
Awesome. And now I want to go back and read Watchmen just to read that issue.
Yeah, you know what? There's a lot of really good books on Watchmen now. We live in like a really cool time where like Watchmen as a story is pretty simple. It's a whodunit. It's nothing like overly complicated, but the way it's told is incredibly complicated and incredibly satisfying, and that's what makes it really stand out. A friend of mine, Sarah, whose name is escaping me, we went to college together, she was a couple years ahead of me, for either her senior thesis or her master's thesis, wrote a book called Watchmen as Literature, and I have just moved, so my copy is packed up. Sarah Van Ness. But that book goes into a lot of these things that I'm talking about and sort of analysis is that I've been able to sort of replicate across other parts of the book that she didn't necessarily look at. But anyone who's listening to this, if you like Watchmen, that's a book that's absolutely worth checking out. It's called Watchmen is Literature.
Awesome. So let's start before I deviate even further and talk about how I want to hate watch the TV show that's coming out. Let's get into the title page.
Yeah. So
or the credits page.
The credits page. Yeah, the credits page is, you know, it's just the same credits page as in the previous issue. Just I swapped out the backgrounds. We talked about this a little bit last time, but I'm real big into packaging, and I also get really bored after I finish writing my scripts. So to keep myself busy, I designed the title pages and the credits pages and some of the other elements that are visual, like the back page. So I liked what I came up with the first one, and I thought it'd be really striking and sort of really good packaging just to have the red from the cover go through. So you have it on this, you have it on the front page, and then on the back page, it's the same as the back page on the first one, but it's got the red swapped in for the yellow. And I think that it really makes for like a nice whole feeling book when you flip it over and you hold it in your hands. Like I feel like a lot of comics don't feel like a whole entity when you hold them and read them, like the pages are in the middle, and I wanted to sort of have a through line throughout it visually and aesthetically and yeah, story wise, and just have all these really complicated intermingling parts that are probably unnecessary and will probably go wholly unnoticed by anyone who doesn't listen to this podcast, but that's all right. It made me happy.
But when you have somebody that also makes comics and does stuff like this and appreciates the medium, they will see it and they will appreciate it. And I mean, you're not always, you know, just singing to an audience that hasn't heard the song before. You're also singing to the choir, I guess, sometimes.
Other musicians. Yeah, I get. Yeah, no, and a few people, at least with the first issue, have had kind words to say about the sort of packaging decisions we've made, and it's not going wholly unnoticed. I was being self-deprecating, like all good writers.
So let's get into, I guess this would be page one.
Yeah, so I thought about this, and we're just going to give the context of the pages, because trying to keep track of where the pages are and the ads and everything, it's too much of a hassle. I tried listening to the last episode, and I couldn't follow along with my own book. So we're on the first page, which has, it's 5 years ago, we see a young Murphy, and we're getting sort of a little bit of context for why Murphy is the way he is. Last issue, we found out that Murphy's adopted, that his parents died when he was very young. And we didn't get a whole lot more other than that he's very bitter about it. So this, to me in my head, it doesn't say it explicitly on the page, but this is sort of Murphy's first night in his foster family's house, or maybe the first few days. And he's overhearing them talking through the door about how, you know, he's not adjusting well and that it's, you know, taking longer than they thought. And the father says, yeah, I wish we had kept trying to have kids. So you get a little bit of the layers peeled back on the parents, like what their decision to adopt was. I really wanted to sort of throw some curveballs into it. Like, Murphy comes off as a real prick in the first issue, and now I want to go back and sort of recontextualize him for the reader. Like, he's got problems, but they're not like unfounded. He's not making them up. He's got some issues, and the parents aren't completely. They're not like angels or demons either. They're complicated and they've got their things going on. And I really just wanted to set this tone. But I also want to use this page to do two other things. One, to establish this sort of cadence of us doing flashbacks for the issue. I wanted to get that in there early because we're going to do a few of them. And I also wanted to add in some of the narration sort of. And the narration sort of looks into like what life is and like how things don't always go your way and like what tragedy is and, you know, what the difference between good and bad is. And then establishing that idea of like there are these sort of pivotal events in your life that tear a hole in you, you know, the loss of a loved one, the end of a marriage. And these are sort of counterpoints to like the birth of a child or getting married or meeting someone and falling in love. Like, life is really a scale, right? Like, good things and bad things happen. But more times than not, the bad things are the ones that stick with us and like really have a hand in making us feel the way we do. If that makes sense.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then on the next page, we've got a black page, just like in the first issue. I really liked that. I like that it made people pause and like take a beat. I also like that it kept my left and right pages where they belong. So I figured I'd do that again. And then we get to the title page, where you get the title of the issue, Holes, which, like I said earlier, this whole issue is, you know, it's going to move the plot forward with Bulmer rolling up with the baseball bat. But we're also going to spend some more time really getting to know the characters and sort of what makes them tick and how they got into their present state of being and mentality when the story is happening. So on the next page, we flash forward to where the story left off. It's our three kids. It's night. It's late. They just found Bulmer's knife out on the ice where Ben died, and Bulmer's about to roll up. The way the cliffhanger was set up, we didn't really know if Bulmer had seen them. We knew they had seen him, but sort of up in there about whether he knew they were there. Turns out he didn't. And Murphy's got a plan. Much to Tank's chagrin, on the next page, we find out that plan is not to run away.
Yeah.
Now, Murphy is on a warpath. He thinks, and maybe he's right, maybe he's not, we don't know yet, but we think that, or he thinks rather, that he knows who killed his friend and he wants revenge. So he's sneaking up on Bulmer, but like all the best laid plans, doesn't work out. He steps on a twig, of all things. Scares the shit out of Bulmer. Bulmer, you know, just sort of blindly swings at who's coming, and they start going at it. And then we end the page with our buddy Avery from the first issue, Clint Eastwood, sort of watching them go at it at the out near the lake from his window in his house. I want to stop on this page for a second and really sort of just talk about some decisions, because I think there's a lot of really cool stuff going on here. The first thing is this was like, I really appreciated the sort of the nighttime coloring Nanad came up with when I saw page 18 of the previous issue, when you like sort of see the purpley dark, very flat colors that he chose. I really liked them, but this was the page where they really like started working together for me. And it's as much Nanad as it is Sean, the letter. It's when you get down to, Avery down at the bottom, you see him in this like muddy, murky color, sort of denoting him as being in the foreground versus, you know, the purples of the outside and the backgrounds. But like that contrast really like allows Avery to pop off the page and call attention to himself. And it's also like the last beat of the page. So it really stands out. And I like that. But, and then Sean really just, to his credit, knew like instinctually almost to sample that color and use it for the white balloon that would be on the white panel, which is number 3. We had this issue with the no borders on our panel or on our bubbles or balloons rather, that if it, you know, Nanad wanted, sorry, what's up?
No, it totally works.
Yes. Well, we I think I said this last time, we modeled the lettering very much after Russ Wooten, who does lettering for Rick Remender a lot. He does Death or Glory. I think he does Deadly Class. And that we liked that like aesthetic of having some panels just have white backgrounds, just so you can really focus on what's happening in the panel. But that left us with this issue where the balloons would have no borders, and if they're white balloons, they'd get lost on the white page and just be floating words, and it might get confusing whether it's a narration or something. So a quick, simple, elegant, and really, really aesthetically pleasing solution of that was just to sample, you know, a prominent color from the page, and sampling that brown really just ties the whole page together. Like if we had the brown down the corner, I feel like it would stand out, it would pop, it'd be really good, but the page would feel less whole. And then having the brown in this, just that one other spot makes all the difference visually. Like, and these are the kinds of things that, you know, before I started making comics, I didn't really notice. Like, I instinctually, I knew it looked good, but I didn't understand why. And now that I've had a hand in making a comic that looks like this, I really appreciate these choices. And it's just like really a testament to how much this book is a collaborative effort. And honestly, more so on the part of Sean and Nanad, especially. Like, these would just be words in a Google Doc if they didn't bring it to life. And I'd be talking about how I want to make comics still. I feel like a lot of the attention's been on me, especially with the first issue and all the interviews and me being on the podcast, being the face of the book. And I try to name drop these guys as often as I can, because I really do believe that this book is as much, if not more, theirs than mine. And I just can't scream from the rooftops enough how important they were to this. So I wanted to take a second to stop and focus on that one minor choice that most people won't even notice, but is really important.
Yeah. It goes beyond making comics. This is page design. This is making it aesthetically pleasing, and they killed it.
Yeah. No, I exactly. I am 100% agreement. So at the end of that page, we get Avery watching out the window. He's in a different color, sort of hopping out of his panel, and we get sort of what I like to call a pre-lap transition. There's not really a defined language for transitions in comics, like outside of a few terms, and they're not like super wide known. So I sort of tried to make my own taxonomy at some point. And for me, a pre-lap is when the words from the next page bleed onto the previous page, and then the vice versa would be the post-lap, where, if, you know, in the last panel, you get like a trail off dot, 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 and like you get the last part of that sentence on the next page. Just a little mechanics lesson. So on the next page, we get a flashback to 10 years ago. We see a much younger Avery standing at a bathroom door, having a conversation with a woman off panel named Katie. Katie is his daughter. And, you know, he's just trying to get her to open up the bathroom door. Something's not right. And he busts through and, you know, very, not so subtly, but very tastefully, we suggest that Katie is overdosed. There's a lighter and a spoon hanging out on the the counter in the bathroom, or is at the edge of the bathtub maybe, and we can assume horrifyingly what's off panel is Katie's body sort of limp and overdosing on the floor, and then that's sort of our big, you know, look into what makes Avery tick. You know, like, why is he this crotchety old fuck all the time? Like, and why does he just want to be left alone? Well, because his daughter died, and if you look too hard into it, either somewhere along the way his wife has died or his wife left him, because he's living on his own, staring out the window in the middle of the night. You know, she's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
So one of the other things I wanted to do with this, like, one of my big problems with mainstream comics is they're a little hand-feedy, if that, you know, is a word. Like, story is sort of hand-fed to readers and over-explained, and it takes up a lot of space. And there's, like, you know, I think readers are really smart, and that they can pick up on some things that you don't necessarily tell them outright. Like, I remember reading Four Kids Walk Into a Bank to sort of prepare for writing this book back when I thought it would be a comedy. And one of the things, and I've never gotten confirmation for this, and, you know, it's weird because I was just talking to Matt Rosenberg two nights ago, and I should have asked him when I was with him. But you, at the end of Four Kids Walk Into a Bank, spoilers for issue 5, so cover your ears. But Berger gets shot, the Jewish kid. You know, he gets shot. And then, you know, you sort of get like a cut to black, and you flash to the, I don't know, 10 years in the future or whatever, 20 years. And all the kids from the story are meeting the main character, whose name escapes me, but she's getting out of prison, and they're meeting her, and Berger's nowhere to be found. Like, he's not in any of the panels in the future. And, you know, that led me at least to theorize that Berger ended up dying of his gunshot wound. It's never explained. It's never explicitly stated, but the information is enough there to suggest it. And that's the kind of stuff that I wanted to really do, because I trust readers. So if you see, you know, Avery all crotchety in the future, and then you see this flashback, I think it's enough to put two and two together. We also state explicitly in the first issue that his daughter dies. But, yeah, there are lots of little examples where we try not to, you know, hand feed everything to readers and really let them enjoy it and explore it and kind of figure out the world for themselves. And I think that is at least one part of why people are responding to the book well, because they don't feel like they're being talked at. They feel like they're, you know, being talked with.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're not coddling the reader. You're giving them a story and letting them digest it on their own.
Exactly. So when we roll on to the next page, The last panel of the previous page, this page, and then the next page are all sort of like one sequence with future, you know, sort of 1999 Avery looking out the window and then transitioning into his flashback and then transitioning onto the third page with another close-up on Avery, sort of like, you know, that's sort of like a cinematic thing. You see that a lot in movies with flashbacks, especially like personalized flashbacks. The camera will pan onto a character for a second. You know, they do it a lot in Lost. Always before the flashbacks in Lost, they would do it. So you get a shot of the character, sort of pause, and you see the character for a second. Then it flashes back, and then the transition back into the present is back on the character again. So that's sort of, you know, I think that's ingrained in me. I don't know that I wrote that to be that way on purpose, but I've seen it in my writing a few times, and I think Lost has really brainwashed me as a writer.
Am I going to have to watch Lost now? Because I avoided that shit like the plague. I have so many friends that were obsessed with it. And
there's some divisive feelings about the show, the quality of the show, the ending of the show. I will say, as a storyteller, whether they had a plan or not, there's a ton of good shit in there. I think that in spite of the ending not living up to people's standards, it's a fine ending, and it is satisfying in its own way. The thing you got to really understand, and that's actually something that I have to keep saying about this book, is that this is a murder mystery, but it's never going to ever be priority, like, about the murder. It's about what happens to the people along the way. Like, Lost was never about, like, the island and all the questions that it asked. Like, those were important, and they needed to be asked and answered, or mostly answered. But it really was about these characters and, like, these great big changes they all went through, and, like, the twists and turns along the way. And, like, that's all good story. So I would say, yes, Lost is absolutely worth it. I would go in with managed expectations. Like, I think there was a ton of hype, and it definitely didn't live up to the hype, but that doesn't mean it was bad. I mean, if you go back and watch now, Batman Begins, which everyone thinks is probably one of the best Batman movies, it's a pretty good Batman movie. know, The Dark Knight definitely stands up, but it is still just, you know, it's not a masterpiece. It's not The Godfather. And for a while there, people thought it was. And, you know, I'm probably losing fans by saying all this, so I'm just going to shut up.
I'll lose them for you. I fell asleep during the first Nolan movie. It bored the shit out of me. My wife liked it. And she's not a comic book person at all. I fell asleep. And then, but the second one I enjoyed.
I think all three of them are very engaging, and I think that, like, as far as trilogies go, they're definitely one of the stronger ones that are out there, up there with, like, Lord of the Rings and The Godfather. I'm going to be that guy that says the first Star Wars trilogy isn't, like, a great trilogy. I think the first two movies are great. I think teddy bears are stupid. But that's beside the point.
It's hard to watch now with the modern eye.
Well, that and, like, we live in an age with so much information that sometimes it's hard to enjoy story because you have too much behind the scenes. He says as he gives a behind the scenes talk about his work. but really, like, once I read up and found out that Return of the Jedi had, what the fuck were they called, Ewoks in it because they thought they could make toys out of them, I was like, well, that's the most commercial bullcrap I've ever heard. And it really took a lot out of the movie for me. And there's some great stuff in them. I mean, everything with Luke and Darth Vader, it's absolutely excellent and great character development. And then you have these fucking angry little teddy bears, which I don't know why everyone says they're cute. They're carrying around skulls. These are dangerous monster aliens. But listen, we're getting way too in the weeds, and I have some opinions about Ewoks, so this could go on for a while. So we're back. All right, we're back in the present. We've had Avery's flashback. We understand a little bit more about who he is.
Let's kick Bulmer's ass.
Yeah. So, you know, Fred Durst, I mean, Bulmer is getting his ass whooped, and the fight's sort of going back and forth, and it looks like Bulmer's about to get the upper hand. And then one of the most satisfying things I've ever written, Murphy cranks Bulmer right in the face with a rock. And this is a perfect panel. You've got profile shot of Bulmer, a white all around, he's done up in the purple, and you've got this rock hitting him right in the nose, and the sound effect is this, like, chipped up silhouette of the word crunch. And, like, that is just, the first time I saw it, it was like the first time I saw my fiance, like, I knew I still know now that this panel is amazing. And then you follow that up with this great sort of bird's eye view, almost from Bulma's perspective, of Murphy saying, "God, you son of a bitch." Like, it's just, I don't know. This is, sometimes when I write, like, I feel like epic isn't the right word, but I feel like the tone and, like, the panel I wrote and the dialogue that's in it, like, they just snap and they pop and they click for me. And this was one of those pages where I just knew, like, in the bottom half that I wrote something that, yeah, if I was reading it, I'd be like, hell yeah, that's right.
And that's a great page turn too.
Yeah, because I mean, I know what happens next, and I still would like to see what happens next. And it's only going to get worse from here, people. But in traditional fashion, as we've set up with the previous pages, on left-hand pages in the book, we are getting a flashback. This time it's 14 years ago. We're getting sort of Ben's backstory, but it's sort of a little bit of a unique take on Ben's backstory. So for the first view, they're sort of like first-person backstories, right? It's directly on the person who we're getting the information about, who we know. This is the first one, and there are a couple in here like this where it's sort of like a third-person flashback, in the sense that this is Ben's backstory, but you're seeing a story about Ben's dad, like a one-page story about Ben's dad. Essentially, this is following up on the fact that Ben's mother died giving childbirth. We're seeing the moment where Ben's dad, who's this, he's kind of a, like, a gruff, not, he's a man's man kind of guy, you know, construction worker-y kind of guy, you know, their stereotypical construction worker, and he's sort of monologuing to baby Ben in the nursery about how he never knew if he could, you know, share somebody, that he didn't want to be a dad, that his dad was abusive when he was growing up, and that he was really turned off by the idea of being a father, but that he loves Ben's mother so much he was absolutely willing to try, and that they were going to make it work. And just as he's sort of, really, he's talking to himself and reassuring himself in the scene, but also telling baby Ben through the glass, just as this is happening, the doctor walks up, and we have these silent panels sort of through the glass, like almost as if Ben's watching this happen from the nursery. And know, knowing what we know about the story so far, we see the reaction on Ben's dad's face that, you know, we know that he just got the news that Ben's mom died from complications from the birth. And then you've got this really sort of very sad panel at the end with Ben's dad looking in on Ben.
He looks broken.
Yeah, and it's a total, like, recontextualization of who he was, like, just two panels ago. Like, he was willing to try, he was willing to do something outside of his comfort zone, and he's just absolutely shattered. And then, so, my hope here was that people would understand that page of Ben and his dad from the first issue, where, you know, you see why Ben's dad, you know, was drinking, and you sort of, again, this is like the reader putting the pieces together. Now you sort of get that Ben's mom died giving childbirth, and that's why Ben's birthday is such a horrible time for Ben's dad. And then that Ben has to sort of grow up a little faster than he needed to, just because his dad's kind of broken. And like, you'll see a little bit of this with Amanda's mom as well in a couple pages. But one of the things that we hear a lot about, not necessarily in pop culture, but we always hear about those kids who have to grow up fast, right? Because they live in a bad neighborhood, or because things didn't go great for them at home, or for one, whatever reason. And I think that that is probably one of the more tragic things that a kid can do. Because, like, I mean, look at childhoods that are, like, just stolen from kids. Like, kids who grow up too fast, they end up being sometimes not the best adults, because they never had a chance to be, like, whimsical and spend time outside, and because they were busy, like, having a job at 14, or because they were taking care of their parents or the other way around. I think we live in, like, a really cool time right now in 2019, because things like D&D are coming back, and superhero stuff is, like, in the mainstream. Like, my grandmother knows the name Thanos and, like, knows who he is. Like, and that's, you know, it's wild in and of its own right, but we live in a really cool time where adults are allowed to not have to be adults all the time. Like, there's board game night at my local comic shop, and there's these fantastic sci-fi movies that, like, you know, people of all generations can enjoy on some level. And just, like, you know, things are so much cooler right now than they ever have been. And, like, I know that it's really hard to see that, because they're also, in a lot of ways, a lot worse than they've ever been. But, you know, again, to me, like, it's very tragic when people have to lose their childhood for whatever reason, because I think that it can turn you into a colder person who's, you know, rooting against sort of whimsy and the shit that makes, like, life actually worth living. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So that's sort of what happened to Ben's dad and that, Ben by extension.
That last panel, the nod is killed that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these flashbacks are pretty hard to write, honestly. Like, just getting them right and fitting them all into one page and really making every panel count. And this one, I think, was especially hard. The tanks was a little harder because it's a lot wordier and there's some technical stuff in there. But this honestly killed me, because, like I said, I feel probably the worst for the people who get robbed of their childhood. So anyway, before I repeat that six more times, we're back on a right page, so we're flashing back to the present. We're picking up where we left off. The kids have now sort of smuggled Bulmer's unconscious body to the clubhouse. It's back. Told you the clubhouse was going to matter. And you see that Murphy is sort of tying him to a chair, you know, and he's got some kind of a plan, and you know, we're giving Tank a moment to shine here, because, you know, like I said, he's the heart of the crew, and by because he's the heart of the crew, he's also the conscience, and he's the guy saying, you know, maybe this isn't the right way to do this. Yeah,
sure that's a felony there, buddy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a club of kids, and no one really is, like, any more important than each other, so it's sort of like a like an undeclared democracy, right? Like, it's sort of majority rules kind of thing. Like, I remember with my friends growing up, like, if one kid wanted to go down to the creek and the other kid wanted to go, you know, shoot hoops at the basketball court, we'd, you know, we'd sort of take a quiet vote, and, you know, whoever wanted to do the thing that voted for most went and did that thing. And that's sort of like the mentality I brought here. And we end this one sort of on, with Tank asking Amanda to cast her vote, you know, do we do this thing, or do we shy away and, like, try and do something else? And then that sort of transitions into Amanda's backstory. We find out a year ago her dad left, And that this isn't the first time that he's sort of walked out and that things just aren't working. And so in the second panel, you get Amanda's mom saying, you know, honey, it's okay. He'll be back. He always comes back. And as we go through the rest of the page, you know, we see it settling in that he's probably not coming back this time. And then we got almost quiet moment on the third panel with just a close up on her mom, just sort of almost in the moment where she breaks. And then for the second half of the page, like it's flipped. It's no longer the mom telling Amanda it's going to be okay. It's Amanda telling her mom it's going to be okay. And then there's just this is the panel I wanted to write for. It's panel 5. It's the second to last panel of the page, and this is what I wanted to get at on this page. It's, you know, in the previous panel we have Amanda saying mom, and then she sort of cuts her off and says, you know, what am I going to do? I don't have anyone else. And we see that moment where sort of Amanda's heart breaks in this moment because, you know, she just got essentially told by her mom that she doesn't matter, that like she doesn't have anyone there to take care of her. And then we see Amanda step up and brush it off, you know, and still try to be there for her mom.
And it looks like she's making, like literally making a decision in that panel. There's no text or anything. It's just her looking very contemplative about what she's going to have to go through.
Yeah, it's a nice beat in the middle of the page to really just sink in on Amanda and like what she's just heard. I think that if we skipped to the next panel without Amanda having a second to breathe on it, like we wouldn't feel the tragic weight of like the situation. Like you can sort of extrapolate so much from that. Like this is a woman who invested so much in her relationship with her husband or boyfriend or whoever had just walked out, that her daughter almost doesn't register as like a person in her life. And I read somewhere that, you know, it's like a cliche in writing that, you know, don't have your, when your characters want to cry, don't let them, so that way the audience will cry for them. And this is sort of like that in action, right? Amanda has every right to like feel totally devastated by what her mother just said to her, and she just chin up and she just tries to deal with the situation. And again, it flips the dynamic. You know, she's the mother now and the mom is the one being taken care of. It's a total upheaval of the model of the parent-child relationship. And in its own way, she's a little bit of a mirror to Ben in that way. Like she has to grow up right now because it's what has to be done. So when we roll on to the next page, and like we left on the last present day page with Tanks, you know, where do you stand on this? And now we understand why Amanda says, you know, Murphy's right. You don't walk out on people. You don't give up on people. And like, cause she just, you know, in flashback, we saw that happen to her mother and we saw what happened as a result. So like we get some real insight of all the characters. We get the most insight into how Amanda ticks and like what drives her decision making from her flashback. I think she's a firm believer that you don't walk out on people, you don't abandon them. That's why she takes care of her mom. That's why she's pissed at her dad that he left them and left her with this horrible situation. So you know, we've got a majority of rules. It's 2-1. And Amanda's sort of explaining her way through her logic. And, you know, it's just like in the first issue, we have that little catchphrase they have with each other. You know, it's what we do. Well, that comes back and like it's not exactly like a great thing anymore. Right? It's this thing that is almost a rationalization for what's about, which isn't the best thing. So in the last panel on this page, we have Murphy saying, OK, let's get started. So then we flash back. And this is my favorite flashback in the whole book. I think it's the most important one.
This one hit me the hardest.
It's. If I could say I was proud of something I ever wrote, this would definitely be it. I think that this is devastating in a vacuum. But we get a flashback to 10 years ago to, you don't know it right away because it's a flashback on a character you haven't seen yet. But now you find out that this is Bulmer's backstory. And essentially, Bulmer's dad, like Bulmer in the present, is a drug dealer. He's working with harder stuff. He's cutting heroin on the table while his kids sitting in front of him watching TV. But like immediately what I wanted to do was like frame Bulmer's dad as being mega complex. Yeah, he's a heroin dealer. Yeah, he's got this fucking badass switchblade. But he also wants to take his kid to a baseball game, and that's a part of the reason he's going out to sell drugs tonight. And it's just like it immediately goes from being this sort of like hardcore crime thing to this this complex, weird father-son relationship. And like just the dialogue on this, I think really sells that this is a guy who cares about his kid and does what he does to take care of his kid. Like it's not necessarily, it's something he's good at, but it's not necessarily something he takes joy in. And just as we're getting this really nice moment, halfway through the page, I flip the script and they get a knock on the door and it's the police. And they're there for Bulmer's dad. And it's this really tragic moment. Like, yeah, he just promised his kid he's going to take him to a baseball game and the kid's excited. And the vehicle by which he can take care of his kid is also the reason he can't now take care of his kid because he's about to get arrested. And I just thought that was like absolutely horrifying. And I was so excited to put that down on paper because I'm a terrible person. Also on this page, you get this sort of origin of the switchblade. Yeah.
He's
cutting the brick of heroin with the switchblade. And when the cops come to the door, he asks, Bulmer to hold the switchblade for him. And you can assume that he probably didn't see his dad after this again. And the switchblade then became his, and that's why he has it in the present. And I just noticed, and I've been doing this a lot lately, that, Nanad put, Bulmer in a Giants jersey. We know from the first issue that the story is set probably somewhere in New Jersey because Tank is a Giants and a New Jersey Devils. But I just noticed that Bulmer is also a Giants fan, and he's a Yankees fan, as the dialogue says. So just it's the little things. I noticed a lot of those running through this. Like every time I reread it, I see these little details they added. Just like the attention to detail is so fucking superb, I can't even.
And the page design on this page specifically, and throughout the book, but on this page, is lovely. I love how they did how he did the 10 years ago. Noting it was a flashback scene.
Yeah.
And again, with the brown letter bubble.
Mm.
So just a lot of really, really good stuff on this page.
Yeah, no, it's a really elegant design. Like, I mean, in terms of eye flow, like you get the 10 years ago and then that bleeds into the first panel and then the second and third panel sort of stacked to the right of it. Then you've got a tier of panels in the second half and you end on sort of a Bulmer in the foreground shot with like this awful thing happening in the background shot and him contemplating the knife. It's like a visual poem in its own weird way. This is, like I said, this is one of my favorite pages, not just because of like it sort of recontextualizing Bulmer as this very tragic figure, but also just because it's a great page to look at. Like it's and, whole.
And the house looks lived in. I like how, you see the TV cord. You see the bunny ears, stuff on the shit on the couch. It's just it looks like people live there, and with their own like maybe they're a little messy, but they live there.
Well, sure. It's from what we can tell, it's never explicitly stated, but they probably live just the two of them. There's probably not a woman in the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's not, but it wouldn't. No woman I know live in this house. They'd have too high, much too much self respect to live in this. Not pigsty, but it's not too clean.
Yeah, it's the house that dudes live in.
Yeah, it's a lower class father, who's a hustler and sells drugs, trying to raise his kid. I mean, this is almost the reverse of the Avery Katie dynamic, right? They live in a kind of nice house and Avery is a nicer dressed guy. And you can assume a lot about Avery by the way he looks. There's the added layer that, I don't know if I'm spoiling something or if we did this in the first issue, but it's heavily implied that Bulmer's dad is the one that sold Katie her drugs. Like you get a little bit of that in the dialogue when you meet Bulmer and Avery for the first time in the first issue. So like there's the whole world is very lived in and everyone's got sort of like these connections and these backstories. And again, I don't know how much of this is going to come out like the first time somebody reads somebody or reads it or at all, but it's just, I don't know. I really just am very proud at how real this all feels like looking back at it now. Like I wrote this about a year and a half ago at this point. So, usually by then I hate what I've written and know, I'm so ashamed and just bury my head in the sand. No, this is, you know, I think that this is a good story. I like it. I'm very much in love with it still after all this time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we get Bulmer's backstory, and honestly, like, of all of them, he might be the most tragic figure of all of them. And like, that I think is my greatest achievement. That those are my machinations, right? I introduce this bully and I make you care about him. And in the next scene, we have Murphy, who we think is a prick, essentially beating the shit out of him. And like, it's essentially a mirror of the opening scene. But I think that by now you're probably rooting in reverse. Like, originally you're probably rooting for Murphy. Now you're like, no, Murphy, stop. Right. Like, it's, I don't even know that I did that on purpose, but that's a fun little dynamic shift there. There's also like these fun little things, like this is what I was talking about. This is a post lap, right? So you, on the Bulmer flashback page, we have a line of dialogue, and then on the next page, we have the following line of dialogue, sort of the transition. So that would be a post lap, like after the fact transition. And in that, it's Bulmer's dad saying, "Keep your eyes closed. Don't look at what's happening with these cops and everything." And then on the next page, we have Murphy punching Bulmer awake. So it's like this very on the nose almost metaphor, like keep your eyes closed, open your eyes kind of thing.
Yeah, that works.
Sometimes I try to be like Alan Moore and I get 1% of the way there.
I think you got it, man.
Yeah, but we see, you know, we're back in the present now. Bulmer's awake. He's sort of sussing out what's going on, and you know, this, honestly, for me, looking back on this page, it doesn't move the plot forward too much, and I'd maybe write this a little more dynamically than I did, but it's, yeah, it moves this plot like a step forward, right? They've got Bulmer awake, and now you sort of get a little more insight to what Murphy's plan was from the last present day page. And now we're getting into Tank's backstory, which, just like Ben's backstory, is not so much from his perspective, but as the perspective of his parents. And what we find out is that Tank was born with a, I called him Hank because he's based on Bobby Hill, and Bobby Hill's been his dad, right? But we find out that he was born with the Texas as well. Hypoplastic left heart syndrome. And essentially what that means is the left side of his heart is a little bit bigger than the right side. And it's just that small deviation in his genetics, like, creates this whole big problem for him. And this is probably the thing I've had to research hardest in my entire writing career, which isn't very long, and I haven't had to research a lot, but this took a lot of time. And back in the 90s, this was a thing that would happen from time to time. I don't remember the statistics, but kids would be born with this, and like, the chances of living a full life were basically zero. Like, yeah, years was likely, teenage years was like really, really unlikely, and then, like, you know, adulthood was like a 0% chance type of thing. And this just gives you like more of a sense of like why his parents are the way they are when you see him for the first time, the first issue. They're working multiple jobs each in long hours because they want to keep their son alive. But they also, there's a sense of detachment. And this is one of those things that I didn't want to write explicitly, but hopefully people pick up on it. They're just so, they know that their son's going to die someday, and much earlier than he should. And it's just, maybe it's easier to be unengaged, and maybe that'll protect them a little bit from being hurt when it comes. But also, like, you get some context into like why they have so many bills, and why Tank is taking medicine, and why he, you know, we were able to build that metaphor of him being the heart of the team, but also having the physically weakest heart. You know, and I tried to make the flashbacks all a little, have a different flavor and have a different sort of, you know, way of conveying the tragedy from different angles and stuff like that. And like, you know, Looking at it and where it fits in the story and understanding Tank's point of view and everything, it's just, you know, Tank is somebody who's very interested in bringing people together, because he tries to desperately do that at home and protect people, but he just can't get it done. And he's got a lot more of a success rate doing it with his friends. But right now that's really being tested, because he really believes they're doing the wrong thing. And, you know, it's just, they're not listening to him. So then when we get back to the present, Murphy's sort of escalating the situation. He's yelling. He's punching Bulmer, and Bulmer is not having any of it. I mean, it's essentially Bulmer saying, "I didn't do it. Fuck you." You know, he's been a tough guy, like the Bulmer we know from the couple of pages we've seen him on throughout the series. So bucking the trend, the next left page is a flash forward, a short one, but it's you know, to a little while later. Instead of going back, we go forward. And one of the things we do in the series is play with time a little bit. There's flashbacks and flash forwards and like viewing things out of order throughout. So I thought that was pretty, it made sense to stick with that. But we see, Murphy's not getting anywhere, and the kids are sort of having a little conference outside the clubhouse. You know, what do we do? Tank's saying, "Hey, again, guys, listen up. Maybe he didn't do it." And Amanda has this sort of offhanded comment, you know, maybe we just need to switch up our approach. And that triggers Murphy to have a new idea. And essentially Murphy's new idea is to up the ante. So on the next page, he walks in and we see Chekhov's switchblade. It was there the whole time, and now it's getting used. And you know, essentially he's threatening Bulmer's life. This is sort of a pivotal scene right here, right? Because this is the first time Amanda's sort of taken by surprise, and we sort of see the very beginnings of her thinking, hey, maybe you're going too far, and Tank is kind of justified now, right? Because he is taking it too far. Even if he did kill Ben, like, this isn't right. We finish the page by having Tank, son of a bitch.
hey, man. Okay, so Tank. I don't think you should torture this guy.
Yeah, Tank.
Bobby Hill, that's my purse. I don't know you.
Yes. So. Sorry, I am so incredibly jet lagged. I got in at 3 a.m. and I got up at 6, and it's now 8 p.m. and too much, not enough sleep. So, cut that last part. So now we see Tank reaching sort of his threshold for bullshit. He's like, nope, not having a part of this. I'm done. You guys are going too far. I'm done. So he walks out. Amanda follows him, saying she can sort of take care of it. And now it's just Bulmer and Murphy. And on the last panel of that page, Murphy's got the blade to Bulmer's throat. He's cut his face. Bulmer's crying. And Bulmer decides he's going to stop being a hard ass and he's going to fucking talk. He finally starts talking, and he, you know, he sort of starts to paint the picture of what happened that night, and that he was hanging out down by the lake, and that he heard some screaming and some yelling. And just as he's about to say who did it, you hear a bang. And then the next panel, he's got one between the eyes. He's been shot in the head. Two more bangs. One bullet hits the little gas lantern they used to light the place, and that crashes down. So, like, I mean, things just absolutely fall apart right here. You know, Bulmer's dead. You know, Bulmer didn't do it. You know, Bulmer's just absolutely so fucking tragic in this story. Yeah, all he wanted to do is like be friends with these kids, and now he's dead because of it. And it gets worse. You know, Murphy realizes what happened, and he tries to get Bulmer's body out of there, and he can't. It's too smoky. He's too heavy, and he has to leave the body behind. So Bulmer gets rejected. Bulmer gets beat. He gets tortured. He gets killed, and then his body is burned. I mean, like, this is some dark shit when you put it like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was not expecting that at all.
Did I mention that I started writing this as a comedy? But this is also like a pretty pivotal page, because for this last sequence of pages, we come back to the narration. And when we opened up on this narration that, you know, there are good days in your life and there are bad things that happen in life. And, you know, the bad things, sometimes they're so bad that they leave a hole in you. And now we've spent this whole issue sort of exploring the holes in these characters. You know, we know what makes Amanda tick. We know why Tank is the way he is. We understand Bulmer. And we've gone through this whole issue. We get it. We've got this new narration that sort of builds on what was, you know, happening before that. And I'll read a little bit of it. And it's just the hard truth is you can't plan for tragedy. One minute things are fine, then everything's fucked. And all you can do is react. Try to minimize the damage. Some things just can't be fixed. And then this is all going on while Murphy's trying to, you know, get the body out.
Desperately, yeah.
Yeah, like I want this narration to really sort of reflect what was going on. Like, things are fucked. He's trying to fix the situation as best he can, but like sometimes it's, you know, it's just lost cause and Bulmer's dead, and like, you know, he's got to get himself out of there. And as he's getting himself out of there on one of these last pages, he sees through the door in this really great frame shot outside, you know, from the inside out into the woods from the clubhouse of this silhouetted figure running into the woods. And we see Murphy start to run after him, and then there's a crash. And you see that on the next page that the clubhouse has collapsed in under the fire, and the narration continues. You know, and while your world is crashing down, life keeps coming at you. You know, and that's like a very on the nose set of narration there. His literal and figurative worlds are sort of crashing down on the page. Life keeps coming at you, indiscriminate like a hurricane. I really like that line. Being from New Jersey, having sort of survived, that's a very dramatic word, but having lived through Hurricane Sandy and lost my house and my parents losing their house, like the idea of being indiscriminate like a hurricane, like really, you know, that life is just chaos, right? Like it's, you know, there's, you know, regardless of what you believe, like the things that happen, like they just do, and you got to react, and that's all you can do. And then the page turn, second to last page, is somebody from off screen or off panel calling Murphy's name. It's Tank. And then on the next page, you see that the third bullet, the third bang, hit Amanda, and she's bleeding. And yeah, that's that. Like, that's where we to be concluded.
Yeah, and it calls back to the cover.
Yes.
Exactly where she had the big red spot. And so everyone, you see, you titled it well. I mean, you see what made their holes.
Yes, and just to be even more clever, the first two issues are both, I think I said this last time, named after other YA coming-of-age stories. The first one was called Wonder Years, named after the late 80s, early 90s TV show of the same name. And this one was named after the book Holes, which I believe Disney made into a movie maybe in the last 10 years, but is another coming-of-age YA story. And I just thought it was very clever doing all that, he said facetiously. yeah, so that's it. I mean, my hope for this issue is that, A, there's like lots of little value adds throughout, like the cover and like getting the little backstories and seeing sort of the not necessarily declared but definitely existing connective tissue between the characters, like, say, like Bulmer and Avery, you know, and like that situation, you know, Bulmer's dad is gone, Avery's kid is gone, you know, Bulmer's a kid and Avery's the dad. Like, I mean, like the sort of all the little inverses I tried to work in there. If it does get them, I think the story's still satisfying without it. But if you do dig, they're there. And then I think this is a pretty solid cliffhanger. Like, I mean, it's definitely one I've seen before. It's a crime book. This is well treaded territory, but I think that when we get into the next issue, it's going to take a big turn, and you know, I don't think people are going to see where it's going right away, or maybe until it hits them. So I think that I keep saying in other interviews and when I talk to people about the book that I really like writing middle issues. First issues are a lot of setup. You got to introduce the characters. You got to get the hook in there. And, you know, the last issues are sort of, you know, right? You're ramping up towards the end. All the pieces are falling into place. And then you end, and then you sort of do a little bit after the ending, the denouement, you know, say this is what happened after. But in the middle, there's a lot of room to flex, like, and a lot of room to explore. And I wanted to make sure that this middle chapter really did its due diligence to work hard towards exploring who these characters are, what makes them tick. And just, I don't know, like if I could give myself a grade on this, it'd be like an A++++. No, I'm kidding. But no, I think I'm this favorite cover, favorite issue. I mean, I think I said this last time, I was brought up on the sort of Joss Whedon school of storytelling, and it's really one of his greatest strengths as a writer is to make you hate somebody and then make you love them. And then you have this complex relationship, like Spike from Buffy the Vampire
Slayer. Oh yeah, for sure.
He's a heinous individual, but when you get his backstory, and I think it's in like season 6, you know, you, you see like the PTSD he had from being like tortured by his mom and like failed romances and how he was just taken advantage of and made bitter. Like, you know, you really feel for him. And it doesn't like necessarily like take away all the heinous shit he's done. He's still a terrible person, but you understand the trauma and what makes him want to be that way. And that was just my hope in this, you know. Murphy's a prick, but here's why it's a prick. Bulmer's not the best guy in town, but here's why. You know, Tank feels this way about things, and here's why he has that point of view. Now, hopefully I was successful.
I think you nailed it, man. And it's it ended in a manner that made me immediately want to start reading issue 3.
Oh, well, lucky for you. Lucky for you, you're going to get to do that so we can do
it. I know, right? Time. Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's that. I think that's probably all I have to say. I bet if you let me talk for a while, I'll just keep talking to fill the space. So,
yeah. But,
think we're good?
Dude, I enjoyed it. Yeah, yeah. And it really kind of brought the story out a little bit more on the back end, on the behind the scenes. I mean, the story's on the page and it reads well, but it's always fun seeing how the sausage is made.
Yeah, you say that, but wait until you try to write stories and then try and enjoy stories. I can only watch Michael Bay Transformer movies now and enjoy them because they're the only ones I don't care how work.
You just have to turn your brain off and
yeah, like
yeah, I, sure that robot's got a big balls or whatever. Sure, fuck it. Yeah, whatever.
But like now when I read comics, I'm always like, well, how did they do that? Like I've been reading House of X and Powers of X recently and just absolutely mind blown by these books. They're so
I need to get on that train.
Wildly inventive, wildly creative, just reworking the way the universe works, and like it's some retconning, but like they do it in such an elegant way that it feels like a natural progression of the story. It's wonderful. I can't wait for all 12 issues to be out so I can sort of read it in one sitting and like take notes, but at the same time that means I can't really enjoy it the way that I used to enjoy comics or movies. But Michael Bay Transformers movies, don't ask me to think. Thanks, Mike.
So, man, I guess we'll put a pin in it right here.
Yeah.
And I'll talk to you, next week?
Well, we got a month now until the next issue. This one had an accelerated release schedule. So we had 2 weeks between issues this time, but we have 4 weeks now. It's actually a little more than 4 weeks. But we can definitely do it in advance if you want to read the last issue.
Oh yeah. Well, I'll read it about 7 times before we get the recording done. But yeah, man, just get back to me and we'll record at your leisure. And man, I've really enjoyed this. Thank you again, Frank. And you guys, Dead End Kids issue number 2 is out now because we're releasing this on Wednesday. It is out today. Go to your LCS. Get it.
Pray to God they ordered it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that didn't go well with issue 1.
Yeah, and shit. I mean, that is such a good problem to have.
Yeah, you know, it's too bad. It's too bad we're recording this now because this is gonna not be useful for anyone. But between the time we recorded the last one and this. Today, the last 8 days, there was a window open to order second prints of number 1. I was able to coax the publisher into doing a second print. There was enough demand for it. So all the people who didn't get number 1 and wanted to check it out had the opportunity to get the story again. But the window was like the day after we recorded until today at 7 p.m.-ish.
Oh, nuts. Okay.
Which was an hour ago. So yeah. Sorry, everybody. But it's on Comixology.
And yeah, yeah.
I believe it's on SpinWiz Comics for $1 still. I'm supposed to change that, but I haven't yet. So maybe take advantage of that while you still can.
So, yeah, get on the ball, read Dead End Kids number 1. And now that issue 2 is out, go to your LCS, get it. Go to Comixology and get it. Read this book because it's a hell of a book and you'll really enjoy it. Frank, you have anything to say before we leave?
Nah. Where about these people go? We'll see you guys next time.
All right. Peace out, buddy.
And we're back.
You know, I got to say, every one of these we do, I love this idea, this series more and more. And it's just getting into the mind of the creator and going through page by page is just...
Well, I think part of it, I would love to have some of the bigger... Like, I shouldn't say that. I would love to have some more of some of the creators from the big two, right? The DCs and the Marvels, to see how their experience is different. Because I think you're going to find that there's not so much more passion, because I think they all love what they're doing, but there's more degree of making sure they get things right. Is that the way to say it for independent?
Right. I think there's twofold, right? I mean, it'd be great to have somebody who's a named creator out there on a big two talk about something that they're passionate about too. Cause that's what I mean. Nobody who's not passionate is going to do one of these commentary tracks, right? It's only going to come from creators who are passionate about what they've done, which is where the fun comes in. And just seeing the somebody who's indie, newer to the scene versus somebody who's been doing it for 30 years, seeing their differences there, that would
be really cool. Would be cool. That's exactly what I was trying to say. Cause I was like, there's no lack of passion when it comes to people who write and create comics as a career. There just isn't, because you have to have a passion to do this.
Right. You don't do this to be a millionaire usually.
Right. I think that time is gone. You know, the Jim Lees and the Todd McFarlanes have already happened. That doesn't mean it can't happen again. Right. I mean, look at Robert Kirkman. It was 10 years later.
Yeah, it happens. You know? But you do comics because you love the medium. You love drawing. You love telling stories.
Yeah. Well, there you guys go. I really hope you enjoyed that section and that page-by-page commentary of Dead End Kids number 2. And we have more to come.
We do. We're lining up more creators for this, which is going to be a lot of fun for us.
Are we doing any more with Frank Ogle on Dead End Kids?
I do believe so. I believe Casey and Frank have agreed to do the next issue as well.
Wow. Yeah. Because that first one was amazing. It really was.
Yeah, it was. The insight was awesome. And the second one's, I mean, I think Frank's going to do them as long as he has time to do them and as long as we're willing to put him out. I'm willing to put him out as long as he's willing to do them. So.
That's perfect. We're willing to put him out.
Yeah, we. It's a team effort. Sorry, I get a little possessive sometimes.
I love it. You should be possessive.
It's passion. I'm passionate, man. I'm passionate. That passion for podcasting.
All right, guys. We're Spoiler the Country. We are heard. Everywhere podcasts are heard. And, of course, we're on all the major social medias that we know about.
Right. And we have a voicemail, 707-656-2080. One more time, 707-656-2080. Give us a call. Let us know what creators and what stories you want to hear us talk about, or talk to the creators about how they did this process with their stories.
Let's go. All right. Well, we hope you guys really enjoyed this. Don't forget, go check out SCPod, scpod.net. It's our website. It has so many articles, all of our podcasts, and, you know, more original stuff. Check out Roach's Den. Check out David Mayer's reviews. We got so much stuff going on there, and we got more to come. It's a fun ride to go through there and see all the stuff that we have for you.
It's a fun ride. Definitely take a look and read and leave some comments and join the community.
There you go. Fun. All right, guys. Don't forget to open the mind.
And read more.
That was way better.
That was more on point and way better. Yeah. Good job. Good job, team.
High five. Virtual.
Hey, buddy. How's it going, man? Frank, can you hear me? Frank? Let's see. Firm.
Hey, can you hear me?
Hey, yeah. Hey, what's up, man? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, yeah, I can.
All right, sorry. I tried to use my headphones and had the...
Well...
How's it going?
Pretty good, man. Got my buddy Keith Stone here. About to talk some comics.
Nice, nice. All right. How's my audio? All good?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm a little more prepared this time. After we did the last one, I did like a write-up for Bleeding Cool, like a writer's commentary.
I saw that.
Yeah, and I wrote most of it out ahead of time this time, so now it's all fresh in my mind. Where did...
All right, I'm going to pull it back up on my phone real quick, and okay. That way I can follow along with you.
Sounds good.
Let me double check, make sure this is recording. Yeah, cool, it's recording. So I'll go ahead and start with the intro. All
right.
let me make sure I have... Holes. Gotcha. All right, everybody. Welcome again to another edition of Spoiler Country. Today, we are talking again to Frank Gogol, author of Dead End Kids. And we are going to talk about issue 2, titled Holes. So this is issue 2 of the new comic series Dead End Kids by Frank Gogol. And Frank, how you doing today, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm a little jet lagged from being in Boston over the weekend, but you know, conventions are always worth it, so I'm happy to be here.
You're all over the place.
I'm trying, man. That's like a huge part of people who are successful, that's a big part of what they do. So I'm just trying to do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So do you want to start this off by saying anything about the book as a whole, or do you want to just dive back into it?
As a whole. Ha ha. Well,